Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
In October 2017, I lost my husband while I was 7 weeks pregnant. And the day he died, I left for work in a hurry. We exchanged some texts after he woke up, discussing a phone interview that he had later that day and the pain that he was experiencing in his leg. We had a quick phone call a couple of hours later where he mentioned that he was running to the pharmacy for pain meds. About an hour after that, I tried calling him several times to make sure that he got home safely, but there was no answer, which was very unlike him. I kept calling him for hours until, finally, a woman answered his phone, and she told me that she was with the sheriff's department and asked me to come home. At the time, I worked in a prison, and fearing that he might have gotten into some sort of trouble, I left my post, got to my car, and sped through the 30-minute drive back to town. As I turned into our parking garage, I saw a large white van that read, Coroner. When I approached our home, I was greeted by the same woman who had spoken to me on the phone, blocking my view into the house. She informed me that my husband had suffered a heart attack, later confirmed as a pulmonary embolism, which explained the leg pain that he had mentioned earlier that morning. Apparently, my husband made it home, locked the security door, and then collapsed. He screamed for help. Our neighbor and her son had heard him and rushed over, but they couldn't get inside because all the doors and windows were locked. The son later apologized for not breaking a window, saying that in his shock and panic, he lost all sense of reason. They spoke to my husband through the door while they called 911, but he stopped responding just moments before help arrived, and he was pronounced dead on arrival. A week or so after his service, his best friend's wife offered me a cleansing and a card reading by her mother. And although I was skeptical, I was desperate for any kind of communication with him or closure. And during the reading, she mentioned many interesting things, but what stood out the most was that my husband was in a stage after death where the soul relives its entire life, similar to when people say that their life flashes before their eyes. She explained that this is a place every soul visits after death as a way to reflect on the life they lived. She also said his death was so sudden that he hadn't yet realized that he had died and that I would need to help him cross over. She felt strongly that I was the one who could help him and instructed me to light white candles and place a jar of water to guide him to peace. Now, a few months later, I moved into my parents' house. One day, while lying on the couch, I suddenly felt a heavy sensation, almost as if I had been administered anesthesia. It felt like sleep paralysis. When I could finally open my eyes, I was still on the couch in my parents' living room, but my husband was sitting on a chair right in front of me, as clear and as real as he had been before he died. Before I could even speak, he started talking. He told me that he was nervous about his upcoming phone interview, the one that he had the day he passed. He said he was excited and hopeful about getting the job and asked for help preparing. I looked at him with tears in my eyes, feeling the weight of what I had to say. I told him, "Baby, I'm so sorry. Do you remember the pain in your leg? You had blood clots. One of them made its way to your heart. You aren't going to make it to the interview, baby. You died." I'll never forget the look on his face. First confusion, then the slow realization of what I had just told him. I apologized again, told him I loved him and begged him to respond, but he just sat there with that strange expression. And suddenly, I woke up. The chair from my parents' kitchen table was now sitting directly in front of me, empty. I never dreamed of him again after that. and I pray it's because I gave him the closure that he needed to cross over. We now have a 5-year-old son who often dreams very specific dreams about his father. He talks about things that he couldn't possibly know unless it came directly from him. Losing my husband was my first real experience with death, but it brought me peace to have my own confirmation that there is something more after this life.
Hey guys, thanks so much for all the support. If you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, please feel free to do so.
It was a nice sunny afternoon in the middle of the winter, and I was trying to soak myself in the sunlight in my garden when I received a phone call from a friend, Megan. She only called whenever she needed a favor, but she was also a very important client whose visits were a major contribution to my profit. So I answered it. "Alexia, why is the salon closed today?" she asked the moment I answered the call. "Didn't I tell you last week that I would be taking a rest from the salon on weekends from now on? It's too tiring working 7 days a week," I said calmly after sipping my herbal tea. "Ah, I forgot about you mentioning that. Can you come to do my hair, please?" she requested. And it was clear that if I wanted to keep her as my client, I had to do what she asked. But I wasn't in the mood to go all the way there. And besides, it would be unfair to the son who showed up in this chilly weather as well. "How about I send you my address and you visit here? One complimentary service of your choice would be on the house then." I knew she would never pass on this offer. "Done." A slight raise in her voice with joy was all the praise I needed for the success of my idea. It was a great deal for me. I could earn a bit of money at home while enjoying this sunlight, and I wouldn't lose the interest of my client as well. So it's a win-win situation. Taking a few sips of my tea, I texted her my address before getting up to set up a chair and a mirror in the garden. It took about 20 minutes to reach my home, and she gave me a ring upon reaching the front gate. I went to welcome her, only to escort her to my beautiful garden, which was going to be my salon for a few hours. I asked my maid, Bella, to prepare some snacks and coffee before we proceed to do her hair, and by the looks of it, she was dressed for some special occasion because she looked fancy as a fashion model. "So, where are you going, looking like a snack?" I asked in a complimenting tone, making her blush with happiness. "It's a friend's wedding. Lots of bachelors would be there tonight, so I was hoping to get the attention of a handsome man. The groom's family is rich, and they wanted a personal makeup artist, so I was going to refer you. But then I remembered you don't do visits." As she said that, I was reminded of the reason why I don't, but I stayed silent and continued smiling. After the snacking was done, it was finally time to do her hair, so I started working on it. The hairstyle she chose was simple, a braided updo that took a maximum of 15 minutes. And she looked amazing after the final touches. For the free service, she asked to do eye makeup that would suit the look. And after giving her a gradient one, I was finally done with my salon for the day. She left after saying her goodbyes and promised to visit the salon next week for spa therapy. A promising client indeed. Though her visit was a good thing for my business, it didn't leave a positive effect on my mind, since she reminded me of guilt I was trying my best to avoid. And now, I couldn't stop those memories from flooding back into my mind. It was around the spring of 5 years ago, when my salon had just started to touch the height of success due to my unique and creative styles for makeup and hair, and as the wedding season had just started, the customer visits had multiplied each day, leaving me little to no time for rest. The level of my enthusiasm was at its peak at the time, so I would continue to work despite being exhausted. The time duration for bridal makeup was around 4 to 5 hours. And sometimes when the bride had additional requests, it would take half a day as well to get her ready. One day, I received an official request from someone rich to visit the bride as her makeup artist, and the pay they were offering was more than enough for 2 days' worth of work, so I accepted it. I left the salon in my assistant Rue's care and headed for the requested address with all the needed equipment and products needed. I was welcomed by 2 servants at the main entrance, and once I stepped in, I was mesmerized by the beauty of the villa in front of my eyes. The person was not just any rich man. He seemed filthy rich, almost like someone who might be a tycoon or something. I started to wonder, why would someone like that hire a nobody like me instead of a famous and well-known makeup artist? I was directly taken to the bride's room on the 2nd floor, through an elevator while passing through a hugely beautiful decorated hall. Guess the wedding was going to commence there, but who knows, it could be somewhere else as well. Anyway, so as I entered the room, I saw a girl curled up in the corner of the bed, looking down with her long and dark eyelashes. Trust me, I had seen many gorgeous women before throughout my life, but this girl, she was the embodiment of beauty. It was almost like I was looking at some angel or a heavenly being. Her every single feature made her alluring to the eyes, almost like every fiber of my being was attracted to her, despite being a perfectly straight girl. As she lifted her gaze, I was met with such deep emerald green eyes, which suited perfectly to her smooth chestnut skin, that almost gave an illusion as if it was made of butter. Her long black hair that was neatly placed on the bed went down her waist, and her soft rose lips quivered as if they were ready to tell me something. I was instructed to do her hair and makeup for the wedding, so I started right away. As I was applying primer onto her skin, I couldn't help but notice despondency in her eyes, almost as if this marriage is some sort of adversity. That was when I noticed a woman entering the room. She checked on her and then left. This was the 3rd time in the past 20 minutes she did that. What is she scared of? Is she thinking I would do something to the bride? And what is up with these 2 bodyguard-type-looking men standing guard outside the room? It's not like someone would harm her here, I thought as I scanned the surrounding. I had been thinking from the time I entered this place, but there was something weird about this wedding. I hadn't seen anyone from the bride's side yet, and even she seems to be in low spirits. If the ceremony was to start soon, they would have been here by now. It was not like it was any of my business, but I couldn't understand what kind of wedding this was. I'm getting forced. Upon hearing her whispers, I looked into her eyes. What? I asked in a hushed voice. Honestly, I couldn't understand what she meant by being forced. These people are some sort of criminals. They kidnapped me, and now they're forcing me to marry someone double my age. Tears filled her eyes as she completed her sentence, only to get silent once again when we noticed the same woman entering the room for the 4th time. Now, I understood what she was checking up on. She must be thinking the bride would tell me the truth about her unwilling wedding, but there was nothing I could do. So I kept my mouth shut and continued to ready her for whatever was coming for her next. She continued to look at me with her compelling eyes, which were desperately pleading for my help, and I would lie if I say I didn't think of calling 911 for her or helping her run away. But I knew from the lavish lifestyle this place's owner was living that he could ruin my life, or worse, he could kill me without a trace. I was too selfish for my own life at the moment, and I decided to turn a blind eye to her problem. I'm sorry, I muttered as I finished doing her hair as well. The devastating look she gave me was heartbreaking. and I didn't have the heart to look at her after that. So I kept my gaze away from her face. As the woman, who was coming and going again and again, entered, she came forward to take the bride away and instructed me to leave the place right away. As I was walking out, I could help but take another glance at the girl when I saw her cold, dead eyes, as if she had lost all hope and will to live. I felt a throbbing pain in my chest, along with a sense of guilt, so I paced out of that place as fast as I could. I could have informed the authorities that something ugly was going on in that gorgeous villa. This thought torments me to this day, and I try to ignore it with all my might. But people always say something that rushes back all this guilt back to me. Whenever I am reminded of that incident, I wish I had rejected that visit request to the client's place. Then I wouldn't have to suffer this self-condemnation.
I'm an 80s girl, not like some millennial who just likes the aesthetic. No, I literally grew up in the 80s, a time for cell phones, internet, satellite TV, when the only thing you could get delivered to your door was milk or pizza. It does seem kind of surreal thinking about it now, just how slowly things changed over the years. And let me tell you what we do. I wish we had some of the things we have back when I was a teenager. It sure would have saved me a lot of trouble from time to time. And this story is one of them. Until I'd saved up enough money for my own car, I'd have to walk to and from work whenever I couldn't wrangle myself up a ride. And that turned out to be most days. Then, this one night, I'm 18, and I'm making the regular walk back to my parents' house when the heavens decide to open up on me. Out of absolutely nowhere, to pure Noah's Ark level of rain that had me running for cover. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some rain, I'm good to walk in. But this was like I'm going to drown levels of rain. So I thought it was better just to take shelter and let it subside a little. But it didn't at all. If anything, it just got more intense. Someone, this older guy, pulled up alongside me in his car to offer me a ride. God knows how he spotted me. I jumped in at the chance. I mean, I saw what was obviously a Bible just sitting there on the dash, and I bet anyone who would have done the same as me and accepted the ride without so much as a second thought. But it didn't take me long to realize I'd made a very, very bad decision. So I got to open the passenger side door of the guy's car. The handle creaks and groans, but doesn't respond right away. This prompts the guy to open up his own door, which seems to open the first time, to tell me that he's been having problems with her for years and that I need to really pull. I do, and give the thing a good yank. Hearing a metallic screech, the door finally opens up so I can climb inside and out of the rain. He apologizes and tells me the doors are real son of the gun, how it doesn't open from the inside and then the windows won't roll down either. He literally tells me this when it's too late to do anything about it. And although I'm not nearly ready to freak out or whatever, the fact that I'm technically trapped definitely made me feel less comfortable. But still, it politely asks me where I'm headed before we make a little small talk about how the rain hadn't been this bad in years. After a while, he began complimenting my uniform, my hair, and told me I looked like his late wife, and that her spirit must have led him to help me get home. Sure, that's one heck of a red flag right there. But at the time, I don't know. It just came across as a sweet as all, like a lonely older guy who pined for a late wife. And you can see where I'm coming from right now anyway. Talked the move to if it was still in school, what my hobbies were, and gradually turned to whether or not I was on my period. Don't ask me how I have no idea how the conversation got to that point. But he wasn't weird about it. And it still seemed natural. I know that sounds crazy, but trust me. It's like he was about to make a joke or something, and it was about as wholesome as period conversations got. And the way he talked was like parental, if that makes any sense. Needless to say, I didn't freak out until he said very calmly, "Because once you blossom into a woman, you should start a family as soon as you're able." as unregistering what he'd said, he goes on to tell me that he believes that God plans to keep him lonely for years, like a test or something. But now, because I look so much like his late wife, who was clear, I was meant to be his. So we could start life over again, and finally have lots of children like his wife was unable to. Then, as I'm staring straight ahead, just feeling my stomach slowly tying itself into knots, he takes my hand, kisses it, and says something like, "It's going to be magical taking you to bed again. Like many girls before me, and doubtless many girls to come." I was faced with the inevitable task of keeping calm enough to keep my captor chill, or coming up with a plan to get out of there safely. And let me tell you, that's not easy to do when all your brain is saying is panic, panic, panic. My first line of defense was feigning surprise, like, "Oh dang, I forgot to clock out of work. Well shucks, looks like I'm going to have to get out of here and walk back." But he responds by telling me it could wait until tomorrow. My second line of defense is telling them that I had to pee real bad, and that's harder to hold when it's that time of the month. I think I was trying to appeal to that parental side that I thought I saw. Turns out, that was my second serious mistake. He told me I could hold it until we got home. Only the way he said it, he didn't sound so sweet. And the more the words "we in home" cut like a knife. And with that, it became obvious that he had absolutely no intention of letting me out of the car. I'm as quiet as a mouse by this point. I've never felt that kind of fear before. So I'm half catatonic as he carries on jabbering about how our lives are going to be. I can actually feel my skin crawl as he tells me that who have to teach me to do things his way, how girls these days don't know how to act. According to him, the husband was boss, and what he said goes, well, his wife's job is to simply submit and obey. It's all right there in the good book, he declared at one point, and twice jabbed a finger into the leather binding on the dash. That's when his idea just burst into life in my head. One that took me all the way back to the handful of Sunday school lessons I had as a kid. If this guy wanted to marry me, he needed my father's permission. Otherwise, our marriage bed wouldn't be holy, or something like that. I mean, I knew that for a fact. So I innocently made the point as non-confrontationally as I could, and from the period of silence that followed, I knew I'd struck a nerve. When he finally spoke again, he talked down to me, saying he knew the Bible much better than I did, that obviously he was going to ask for my father's permission. Then we got to the street where I previously told him I lived. He asked, "Which house is my parents?" I gave him a fake house number far away from mine and had him drop me off there. He wanted to come inside. I told him I needed to let my parents know that God had sent me a husband. He couldn't just walk up in there uninvited if he wanted my dad to say yes to the whole thing. I said it might take a few days to convince them that they should come back tomorrow. He responds with, "I'll give you a few minutes, but we need to be on our way." I told him to drive around the block so I could have time to pack my clothes. He nodded, and finally opened the car door. I ran to the house door, waving him until we drove away, then sprinted to my actual house where I told my parents everything. The cops were called, and we watched as they showed up and talked to the guy before they just let him go. I was furious, but apparently, he just told them that he had given me a ride home and had no idea what I was talking about when it came to all the kidnap and marriage stuff. We were assured that his details had been taken, and that if he tried anything, he'd be easy to get in touch with. But if there was actually a next time, it might not just be him they have to find, and might have been my body too. Thankfully, I never saw him again. But in the future, I insisted on waiting at work until my boyfriend could pick me up. Failing that, I'd just cough up the money for a cab, even if it did cut into my tips. I mean, there'd be no spending cash that if I was locked in some fundamentalist basement, right? The point was, is that be careful whose car you're getting into, girls, because you really never know who's actually sitting behind the wheel. And the people who came across as the kindest can sometimes be anything but.
In the year 2001, movie theaters across the country were terrified by the demonic evil of the antagonists in Jeepers Creepers. The movie is the story of a brother-sister duo whose road trip is turned into a living nightmare by an immortal creature who hungers for their body parts. It's certainly a fantastical tale, but you may be surprised to learn that one of the movie's most terrifying scenes is actually very much based on reality. More than a decade prior to the release of the film, a woman named Marilyn Depew was reported missing on Easter Sunday of 1990. Marilyn's neighbors strongly suspected that her husband Dennis was responsible for the disappearance, as it was common knowledge around the neighborhood that the Depews had something of a rocky marriage. Many gossiped that Dennis had violently snapped when Marilyn finally professed a desire to end what had been a miserable marriage. The reality wasn't far off. After severely beating her in front of their three children, Dennis Depew lied to them, telling them that he was going to take their mother to the hospital. Instead, Dennis drove the dazed and bloodied Marilyn out into the woods and shot her in the back of the head. Since he was on some pretty isolated Michigan back roads while he was dumping his wife's body, Dennis Depew assumed that he would be undisturbed. It was rare to find any vehicle at all driving down that stretch of road, but as fortune would have it, a married couple by the name of Ray and Marie Thornton were headed Dennis's way. They slowed as they saw an abandoned schoolhouse at the roadside, just in time to catch a glimpse of Dennis Depew, holding a horribly familiar shape wrapped in a bloody off-white sheet. Horrified by what they'd seen, the couple raced down the dirt road, only to find that a man who had evidently killed once before was now pursuing them at breakneck speed. The ensuing car chase between Dennis and the Thornton couple will seem eerily familiar to anyone who has watched Jeepers Creepers, since this confrontation is essentially reenacted during the first portion of the movie. Even the build-up to the horrifying discovery is almost identical as, much like the movie's protagonists, the Thorntons also happen to be playing the license plate game. Although director Victor Salva never cited the Depew murder as inspiration, it's rather hard to imagine that he wasn't influenced by it in some way. After failing to catch up with the Thorntons, Dennis Pew then hid the truck he'd used to chase them, and for a good long while, there was no concrete leads on who killed the woman whose body was found behind that old abandoned church. Then one night, many months later, Dennis sat down to watch an episode of Unsolved Mysteries to find that the focus of that night's feature sounded strangely familiar. The show's narrator detailed a murder that had taken place in rural Michigan, and it also featured the testimony of a young married couple who had been chased down a stretch of highway after having witnessed the disposal of a corpse. The realization hit Dennis like a ton of bricks. They were talking about him and his wife, and by that point he was officially the case's primary suspect. He panicked, jumped into his new truck, and fled to the safety of a hideout in Texas, where he lived for 11 months under an assumed name. But after Hank Queen was discovered to be none other than Dennis Depew, and members of the public contacted law enforcement, it was Dennis's turn to be chased down a lonely stretch of highway, but this time, it was the police that were in hot pursuit. The lengthy chase ended in the state of Mississippi, where Dennis got out of his vehicle, put a pistol to his temple, and pulled the trigger. The footage from the episode of Unsolved Mysteries, the one that sent Dennis into a blind panic, can be found online, and it's fascinating to notice the obvious similarities between the movie and the real-world events. Yet something about the inclusion of an ancient demonic evil seems to take the sting out of the depicted events. We can watch a movie like Jeepers Creepers, then sleep soundly in our beds, safe in the apparent knowledge that it was only a movie. But the fact is, it isn't just a movie. For a good chunk of the film, the events are an exact recreation of a real-life event that almost ended in the brutal murders of a young Michigan couple by an unrepentant, bloodthirsty monster. A man who poses a much more tangible threat than any make-believe movie monster.